I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, born on the dance floor in the 1970s amidst the shadow of post-Nixon America in a bruising recession, disco offered an escape from American disillusionment and economic hardship. Emerging from the urban underground clubs, disco celebrated inclusivity, hedonism, and liberation. When it became a commercial success, it became a cultural force that today may seem vacant and superficial, but there was a deeper cultural significance. But the disco ball can only shine for so long, and there was a violent backlash, and overnight its popularity collapsed. Despite flaming out, disco's influence on music, fashion, and culture endures. We relive the magic of those disco nights with David Hamsley, author of To Disco With Love. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
The City of San Antonio Revitalized SA Corridor Leadership Program offers no-cost training for those interested in neighborhood commercial corridor revitalization. Over 9 months, participants will obtain leadership and strategy skills and have an opportunity for grant funding. Applications at sanantonio.gov/edd/revitalizeSA. This nonprofit message is underwritten by the Economic Development Department.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This is the song that many say helped ignite the disco fever that took over America in the 1970s. George Macrae's Rock Your Baby was a massive international hit. The song reached number one on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100 single chart in July 1974. It sold over 11 million records. The infectious rhythm that is credited for the song's success was written by Richard Finch and Harry Wayne Casey of Casey and the Sunshine Band. They said they wrote the song after studying the evolving scene at the dance clubs of Miami. Soon there was a plethora of imitators and disco history was made. And it's a history that's told in the book, To Disco With Love, The Records That Defined an Era, by David Hamsley.
Means so much. I love dancing. Disco was just starting to happen when I was coming of age at 18, 19, 20. Fun times.
Where were you?
I was a student in Rhode Island, Providence, Rhode Island. I was going to Rhode Island School of Design. There were only two discos in Providence at the time.
People have an attitude that disco was a form of music that was dance music, but not much more than that. And it may have seen it as kind of trifling, but there's an interesting backstory to how disco came about and the liberation culture that it was the soundtrack for. Can you talk a little bit about that story?
If you're talking about gay liberation, it became a centerpiece around which a lot of guys could gather and dance together. Interesting to think about that in 1977, 76, 75, it was still technically criminal to be gay, at least in New York. But all this was happening anyway. And here we are 40 years later, and now we have marriage equality.
Like, we had this Stonewall riot. They call it a riot, but it was more like just a defiance, act of defiance. And
1969.
At that time, there was a cabaret law in New York City that that would prohibited same-sex dancing. If you were going to dance, you had to be male, female. And after Stonewall, there was an activism in which they were able to repeal that ordinance. And suddenly, there could be gay clubs, and gay clubs needed, they wanted to have music, nonstop music and heavy beat dancing, and that created the framework and the their scaffolding to create disco?
Yes, I agree with that.
So what would be some of the an early song that might have been played in those early days of before disco was even a word, there was still music that was being taken, I guess, mainly from Motown that was being incorporated into the, that scene?
I kind of think of Barry White as a point of departure and his aesthetic of lushly orchestrated soul. He had a huge hit with an instrumental song called Love's Theme in, I think, late 1973. And that really established an aesthetic, an American aesthetic. Lots of violins. I mean, his orchestra had 50, 60 people in it.
So that was a song that they would have played at the Loft in New York City?
You know? Oh, sure. Yeah. Yes. That one was a hit on radio, but shortly thereafter, the hits started coming out of the disco and then becoming hits on the radio because you'd hear them dancing on Friday and Saturday night, and then you'd go and ask your radio DJ to play them, or you'd start buying them, and the radio DJs couldn't ignore it because of the sales.
The radio songs had to be about 3.5 minutes long.
Yes. Disco changed that. Disco, the long version became almost mandatory. And a guy named Tom Moulton is generally credited for having invented the long version. With a long version, you could really get involved with the song on the dance floor. 3.5 minutes it's not enough time, but seven. Then you could really groove away to like an instrumental section, a nice bass line, something like that. It became a hallmark of disco, the long version.
Tom Moulton was at many of the innovations that created a disco, the disco era, including a lot of the computerized sounds that we see as hallmarks of disco.
He was just a genius. He had an infallible ear. He just knew what was the great part of the song that you wanted to emphasize. He's still doing it, too.
So what's a good Tom Moulton song to sort of point out here?
Instant Replay by Dan Hartman.
You set my lips on fire.
When did we start hearing the word disco? Where did that come from?
Well, discotheque meant record library in French. I heard the word as early as 74. Well, the first charts started appearing in Billboard magazine in November 1974. They called them Disco Top 10.
Did people know what they meant by that? You know, there's got to be some sort of foundational understanding of, like, we come up with a new word, how does that permeate the culture? You know, where do people say, oh, that's a disco song, I know what that means?
I would say it came out of the underground. In those early years, it was underground.
Sure, with DJs doing the remixes.
Yes, usually it was on little 7-inch 45s. One side would be the vocal and the other side would be the instrumental. And a clever DJ could mix back and forth between the two. You know, then entered Tom Moulton with the long version. And something else that he did that was just extraordinary, really changed everything, was the 12-inch single, which was a record the size of a conventional 12-inch record album, but only had one song on it, and the grooves were cut very wide so that the sound was very loud. And you could play it loud over your discotech loudspeakers, and it had minimal distortion.
Stand by, we have more Source and Disco coming up right after this break. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Disco in the 1970s was more than a fad of music and dancing. It became a sweeping cultural phenomenon that left its stylistic imprint on nearly every facet of American life. Disco's influence extended to graphic design, where bold geometric patterns, shimmering metallic tones, and futuristic fonts echoed the flashing lights and pulsating rhythms of the dance floor. Fashion was transformed as well, with leisure suits for men. Sequins, jumpsuits, and platform shoes became the uniform of the nightlife. At its heart, disco was an era of excess, a celebration of liberation during a time of America's malaise. Yet viewed through the lens of nostalgia, disco's indulgence and hedonism seems almost innocent. For all of its excesses, it was a time unburdened by the complexities of today, and disco was the soundtrack. In 1974, there was an album released by Gloria Gaynor, and it had the cover of the Jacksons' Never Can Say Goodbye. And this was a big hit on the dance floors and discos, and seen as a big breakout song for disco.
What was special about that record was that it was the album was segued. There was no space in between songs. Again, this is Tom Moulton's doing. There were three songs on side one, and each one blended into another, just as if you were in the disco. So you could take it to your basement and imagine that you were dancing at a disco because there was no stopping.
So it was a continuous playing, one song after another on that album side. Tom Moulton said, we can put this out there and DJs can smoke a cigarette or have a breather.
Exactly.
And it became an institution in the clubs.
Yes. And in the basements, too. You could take it home and dance, dance, dance.
Or make sure that when you showed up for the club that you had all your moves.
Well, of course. You have to practice.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking with David Hamsley to Disco with Love Records that defined the era. We're talking about what happened when disco exploded across America. That's the song MacArthur Park, sung by Donna Summer. It was one of her many, many hits. But Donna Summer was the queen of disco as disco took over American culture in the 1970s. We're speaking with David Hamsley, author of the book To Disco with Love, Records That Defined an Era. So, David, how critical was the presence of Donna Summer to disco?
Very critical. I think her album, Love to Love You Baby, was a game changer. Very important for a couple of reasons. One thing was that the ecstatic groans that she really pushed the envelope in terms of what was commercially acceptable. And the other thing about it was recorded in Munich, Germany. The song went on for an entire side, 16, 17 minutes, one song. And that effectively set a template for what became known as Eurodisco. Eurodisco might be characterized as being a little more mechanical than American disco, which was more soulful. Think thud, 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 thud. less orchestrated than American disco, and often explored one song for an entire side. And during that time, you got to really break it down and build it up a couple of times and have, like Donna Summer did, numerous climaxes.
Last Dance, which was always the song that you played last at the high school dance.
So let's dance.
It was associated with the movie Thank God It's Friday, which was meant to compete with Saturday Night Fever. It was Casablanca Records and Filmworks' take on Saturday Night Fever. And that song, written by Paul Jabara, the song won an Oscar. And it's generally recognized that Thank God It's Friday was the worst movie to ever earn an Oscar.
Donna Summer's success must have brought out the Imitators. Who are some of the Imitators?
Countless Imitators. Andrea True. She had a fantastic hit record. Andrea True was an adult actress.
That was More, More, More? Is that it?
Yes, yes. One of my all-time favorites. I still like to listen to it. There were a million Imitators because with the acceptance of this kind of overt sexuality and the ecstatic groaning, all of a sudden every record had to have a component. At least somewhere in the song, there would be somebody groaning or shrieking.
Diana Ross, in her song Love Hangover, that came out in 1976. And was she like saying, well, if Donna Summer is doing all this and getting all this attention, maybe I should try my hand.
Yeah, yes, I think you're right. Diana Ross's record, she's one of my all-time favorites, and that song might possibly be my number one fave of the era. Her albums were not disco albums per se. She covered a lot of a big variety of material, and so yes, I'm sure her producer said, "We need to get you." It the disco audience, and that was the result. Love Hangover.
I got the sweetest hangover. Sweetest hangover. Yeah. I don't want to get over. I don't want to get.
Music is being played in the gay clubs, but it's still talking about opposite sex relationships. I mean, when do we start starting to really, the Village People, is that who's really talking, able to really kind of break through?
Yes, I think that was a breakthrough album. If you think about it, not too many years after the Stonewall event, here's a group of guys that are openly singing about gay life in San Francisco and Hollywood and Fire Island. It was an overnight sensation. The subsequent albums, they became, I think, less authentic. The gay community really didn't care for them very much because they became cartoons. But that made the whole conversation palatable to the rest of the country and the world. They were international superstars.
Yeah, they're like showing up at halftime shows and on Donnie.
Yeah,
and
right.
Donnie and Marie with the Village People, and you're wondering like, what is happening here? Do they even know what's going on?
Gee, I've often wondered that myself. If you heard the first album, you had to know. But after that, they became a product, and they only really lasted about 2 years. And by 1979, they were over. But that first album was, I think, really important. 1977 had some really critical turning points, and that was one of them. Summer of 77, it was almost like the Summer of Love 10 years later.
David Hamsley is with us. He's the author of To Disco With Love, The Records That Defined an Era. You said, David, that 1977 was a watershed year for coming up with great disco music. Commodores, The Brick House would have been one of those tunes.
Mm-hmm. I love that one. It's a great one. That's kind of a funky song. I think some of the important stuff, we didn't know how important it was going to be. Like in the spring of 77, you had Kraftwerk's Trans Europe Express album, and the more progressive DJs were playing that, and it was made up of all electronic instruments, and I don't think anyone knew how important it was going to become in just a few years when in the 80s we have our digital revolution.
What was the formula for putting together a good disco song?
Tempo. Start with the tempo. And then maybe add the bass line. That brought the groove into the song. And it was just after that, layers and layers of sound, instruments.
Catchy hook.
It didn't even really have to have much of a lyrical content. The groove and the hook was what it was all about.
Another big hit-making machine was KC and the Sunshine Band. And they were, you know, a Miami band. They were producing music that seemed like hit the sweet spot. It had a soul roots, R&B funk, but also cleaned up pop with a lot of polish. And that seemed just like it sort of was the, in Super Drive, we could play this in the clubs, we can play this on the radio, we could put them on TV.
It was fantastic. I loved them. I still play it. One of the things that they had going for them was, he was very charismatic and personable. He looked great on stage. And they had a horn section, three guys playing the horns, and they had three girls with tambourines, and everybody was wearing splashy, very colorful outfits. It was a great show. It was fun to see as well as listen to. It's still a fantastic song. You can go to the Macy's Day Parade and hear it played. This, or go to a wedding and they're still playing those songs.
When we come back, Disco Goes to the Movies with John Travolta and the Bee Gees on Texas Public Radio. Stick around. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Bee Gees' iconic disco anthem, Stayin' Alive, was written for the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. It's a song that blends infectious rhythms with surprisingly dark and introspective lyrics. At its core, Stayin' Alive is about resilience and survival, capturing the struggle and determination of not surrendering to life's challenges. With lines like, "Life going nowhere, somebody help me," it's clear the song's lyrics are describing life in a gritty urban environment, touching on themes of hardship, alienation, and frustration. Not what many would associate with the superficial tinsel of the disco lifestyle. Saturday Night Fever, released in 1977, was a cultural juggernaut that reshaped both film and music industries. It turned disco from being an American subculture to the dominant cultural force of the 1970s. David Hamsley writes about that in his book, To Disco with Love, The Records That Defined an Era. Where were you, David, when you saw the film Saturday Night Fever?
I was a student. I was in, I guess, my second year of college. I was a little ambivalent about the film because it was not my disco experience at all. And I somehow must have intuitively known that this overexposure that came along with the movie was going to spell trouble for my beloved disco, and it did.
Oh, forget this.
Look out, give the kid some room. He's taking over again.
And it's something that's kind of interesting about this, that soundtrack, which sold, I think, 15 million copies. I mean, you want to talk overexposure? 15 million copies. Is that all of those songs were hits in the disco months before the movie came out. It was a low-budget soundtrack. They just picked up hits that had already come out. And lucky for the Bee Gees, it did. It really propelled them into international stardom. And all the other songs that were selected, like The Tramps' Disco Inferno, they caught a free ride.
Movie based on a New York Magazine article, mm-hmm. which I had read when it came out, and I read it with curiosity, just being a high school kid. It was this, and then seeing the film and how they Hollywoodized it. Mm-hmm. When you talk about the soundtrack and how they just picked up all these songs and shoved them in together in this double disc mm-hmm. soundtrack that was mm-hmm. released, then one of the top selling albums of all time, and it changed the industry. that you could make so much money from the soundtrack, almost as much from the soundtrack as you could from the film.
Yes, Hollywood was not slow to exploit that. Lots of movies with disco soundtracks followed.
And thank God it's Friday, Car Wash, another one.
Yes, right. And the movie now, all these years later, is generally highly regarded. Smithsonian selected it as something to restore and preserve for eternity.
Would you like to know what I do?
It's not necessary.
I'll tell you what I do. I work in a paint store, and I got raised this week.
Right. You work in a paint store, right?
Yeah.
You probably live with your family, you hang out with your buddies, and on Saturday night you go, you blow it all off 2001, right?
That's right.
You're a cliche. You're nowhere. On your way to no place.
It's a dark movie. And I think now that the disco craze itself has subsided, you can see the movie for the movie. Something that the disco aesthetic had going for it, that you could discify anything. You could take a slow classic song like Swanee River. You could give Swanee River a disco treatment.
And they were doing you that.
Could, yeah.
And they took some of Glenn Miller's songs and they discofied
exactly.
them.
That really means you can do anything.
They took took the Star Wars movie and they made it into a disco album. As you have in your book.
The disco version outsold the serious version.
So your book, you're looking at the graphic art of disco. You're looking at the record album covers.
Well, as a photographer, it's very natural for me to key into all of that, the way the music was packaged, what the people were wearing, the typography, all of that kind of thing was something that I studied pretty carefully. Usually it was scantily clad girls on roller skates or lighting scenarios where the cover is just all this kind of disco lighting, crazy disco lighting and strobe effects.
Well, you know, so when we saw album covers for, say, like the Jacksons, Thelma Houston, efforts to portray people as glamorous,
yes,
as serious.
Definitely. There was definitely a lot of glamorous.
Baby, my heart is full of love and desire for you. Now come on.
But those artists that you just mentioned, the Jacksons and Thelma Houston, were and are regarded as very highly regarded as serious music by serious artists. There was a lot of disco one-offs, just productions. They had just one album. They had somebody got an idea, and they managed to get it out there, and it became a hit.
The Weather Girls with It's Raining Men,
uh-huh.
Is that one of these one-off type of records?
The Weather Girls were the backup singers for Sylvester, and they were San Francisco-based. When they sang backup for him, they were known as Two Tons of Fun, but some people found that offensive, so they changed their name to The Weather Girls. And it also was later in the cycle. I think it might have even been 80s.
It's in 82.
Oh, okay. At that point, disco had moved on to some other incarnation.
But there were still people wanting to dance. When we come back, the party is over for disco. The backlash against disco gets ugly, racist, and homophobic. The Source continues after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. To Disco with Love is the book, the records that defined an era. I'm speaking with the author, David Hamsley. There were a lot of people who jumped on the disco bandwagon, and this is Ethel Merman singing disco, and it happened. David Hamsley, why did Ethel Merman start singing disco?
Well, I guess for the same reason all the others showed up at the party. Disco could sustain your career. It could bring you back from the dead. And I guess she hoped that she would find a whole new audience. Unfortunately for her, she was too late. I think the album came out in late 1979. It was not a commercial success.
If it had been earlier, you think it would have found an audience?
Would have had a better chance, for sure.
But, okay.
Because she's such a gay icon, too. Ethel Merman, the Merm, everything. They discified everything, and everybody wanted to check it out.
The Rolling Stones.
They were criticized. Their fans were a little worried, but they managed to do it without sacrificing their stonishness.
And then there were people like Rod Stewart, who produced a Do You Think I'm Sexy, and his, I don't think his fans ever got over that.
No, I don't think so. Just reach out and touch me, come on, honey, tell me so. I didn't mind it. I, you know, the more the merrier, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, and that was certainly what was happening, because there were more. Everyone was jumping on the disco mm-hmm. bandwagon, and I think to a point where the wheels came off the wagon. There were too many people mm-hmm. on top of it. Is that why we saw a backlash? I mean, to me, it wasn't just disco wasn't just in the dance clubs. It was in the movie house. It was on the TV. They would come up with the TV shows like Making It, which was like disco sitcom. It was the fashion, you know, with leisure suits and polyester bell-bottom pants. And
a lifestyle.
Was a lifestyle. And if it wasn't your lifestyle, you may have felt like, where do I fit in here?
I guess that's what happened. I never really noticed it. I didn't pay any mind to, say, the riot at Comiskey Park. It didn't mean anything to me. But it, just as you said, if that's not your lifestyle and it's, you can't dance very well and you don't want to wear those clothes, you have a backlash.
This is now officially the world's largest anti-disco rally. We took all the disco records that you brought tonight.
You mentioned the riot at the ballpark. So we had a DJ, and he said, bring your disco records, and we're going to burn them.
Yeah, his name was Steve Dahl, and he was a radio personality at WLUP-FM in Chicago.
As we said, between game activities, the main attraction, the disco demolition, spearheaded by morning radio man Steve Dahl and his anti-disco army called the Insane Coho Lips. Earlier, I asked Steve just what he has against disco.
Well, the first thing I have against it is that I can never find a white three-piece suit that fits me off the rack. So I hate the taste of pina coladas.
And as late as July 79, radio stations were still switching to in all disco format, and as a result he lost his job, and he got the idea to do a stage an event at a Chicago White Sox doubleheader that if you showed up with a disco album you could enter for 98 cents. Everyone's astonishment, tens of thousands of people showed up.
Records flew like frisbees, more fireworks exploded, bottles were thrown, and an estimated 7,000 spectators staged their very own demolition. Four fans were injured during the melee, 40 others arrested.
And in between games, they put this pile of vinyl on the field and blew it up. And the people that were in the bleachers took that as a cue to rush onto the field and just run amok. They rioted, and the cops had to come in and break it up. That was quite a backlash.
New Center 5 staffer Mike Pumo is out there at Comiskey Park, and we have him on the phone right now. Mike?
Hello. Jim.
Yes, what's the current situation?
They just canceled the second game.
They canceled the second game
because the field is unplayable, as determined by the umpires.
Some people have said that the disco sucks backlash may have roots in homophobia, or also people who didn't like the interracial qualities of a disco, mm-hmm. and maybe it was particularly not palatable to people in the Midwest.
That sounds accurate to me. I'm sure all of those elements were present.
It's astonishing that something that could be so popular, making all this money and all these records being sold, could have such a violent backlash.
Yes, it shocks me too, because it started out so innocently. It didn't even have the name, as we were talking about earlier. You know, you didn't even know what it was. It was just getting together with your friends at the bar. And, oh, look, they have a dance floor there, and they got this guy in the corner that plays records. Let's go over there. So innocent. And in just a few short years, in 5 years, it met this violent end.
Despite the happening in that ballpark that day and people who proclaimed that disco was dead, is disco dead?
No, not at all. I think that it's incredibly durable, much, maybe more now. I mean, I'm surprised at how much I still come in contact with it. I mean, if you walk into a supermarket, and it's not unusual to hear some great disco hit over the PA speakers, and personally speaking, my mood often improves, and I have to kind of keep myself from putting too much swing in my shoulders as I walk down the aisle. But then you look over and you see somebody else is also listening to it, and maybe singing under their breath. Or one time I'm online in the supermarket, and there's a disco song playing, and ahead of me is a woman with her new baby in the shopping cart, and she's singing the song to the baby and clapping, manipulating his hands like clap, clap, clap. And I thought to myself, oh God, this music is going to live forever.
David Hamsley is the author of To Disco With Love, The Records That Defined an Era. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies.